Grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. So the Simple Actions Group wishes to extend a warm welcome to all in attendance today. Newcomers, is there anyone in their first 30 days of sobriety? We would like to welcome you. You can unmute yourself or raise your hand in the chat. We just, with just your first name, we just like to say hello and welcome you. Anyone in their first 30 days? Okay, I don't see anybody. If anyone in here is a newcomer and you'd like your number passed along, just send it to the host or co-host through the chat, and we'll get you some numbers or hang out after the meeting, and we'll chat with you. So I'm going to read the preamble. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution, does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. And the format of this meeting is an open speaker meeting with an ask it basket. And tonight we are excited to welcome Stacy to tell her story. After our speaker tells her story or whatever she'd like to talk about for the next, say, 55 minutes to an hour, we'll then take a break and call for announcements in the seventh tradition. And then we'll ask questions of the speaker. So please feel free to send those questions in the chat to David or to the questions guy up there. So tonight, Stacy is joining us virtually from San Antonio, Texas. And help me welcome Stacy.
Thank you, Leanne. My name is Stacy, and I am an alcoholic. By the grace of God, the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, the 12 steps and 12 traditions working in my life, and some really mean sponsorship, I haven't had a drink since April the 25th of 2003, and for that, I'm as grateful as I know how to be. And thank you again, Leanne, for your service. David, thank you for reaching out and asking me to talk in this meeting. I was actually at work when David called me about this meeting, and my cell phone is, because of, you know, everything being virtual, my cell phone is the means by which people contact me now for work. And so I answered the phone in my professional voice using my professional title, and David was on the other end, and he was like, "Hi, I'm David, and I'm a knee-walking drunk." And boy, he just brightened up my day. I just needed that. You know, you need that in the middle of like taking yourself too seriously, you know? So thank you so much for inviting me. Thank you for your correspondence and helping me to get here successfully. I'm excited to see Alcoholics Anonymous in all facets right now. We were just talking about that before the meeting, the gift that has come as a result of this very uncertain time that we're in. Is these virtual meetings and me getting to meet alcoholics from all over the country and other countries. And I just can't be more excited about that. You know, it hasn't been an easy time. I'm kind of in that space that they talk about in the 12 and 12 where, or actually, no, I would have to say, if you asked me honestly where I am right now as a result of everything that's going on, I'd have to describe my current situation as I am not inspired at all times. And yeah, since this whole thing started, I have paid for that presumption and all sorts of absurd actions and ideas. When I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm so grateful that my sponsor, the woman who took me through the work the first time, knew me by reputation in my home group and knew that she had to set the bar really low. So she gave me three rules when I got here. She said, "Don't kill yourself, don't kill anybody else, and don't drink. We'll fix everything else." And, you know, it's been one of those times where I've had to just follow the three rules and Thank God we have a process and a program by which we can clean up messes and we can still be of service. That the God of my understanding does not need me to be constantly spiritually fit to use me in ways that he sees me as necessary, kind of like today. So you know, that's just what's going on in my life. And it seems as though when life gets funny, Alcoholics Anonymous, you appear. And you don't appear as my sponsor says, the cavalry is coming, you know? You don't appear to come and like, you know, just hold on to me and pat me and love me. No, you come with service commitments. You ask me to do things. And that's kind of where I'm at today. And it kind of takes me to a story that I've been telling often lately. And that is almost 3 years ago in March, I had a really terrible accident at work. And it was just a really bad situation. I was injured really badly. And I had to report it, and they opened a workman's comp claim, and I got sent to physical therapy, and the conservative efforts to try to fix my injury failed. And so they had to send me for diagnostics, and an MRI revealed that I have a herniated disc and a slip disc. And I'm one of those small percentage of people that is going to live the rest of my life with chronic pain as a result of it. What it looks like on a bad day, on a good day, I just have a little bit of pain in my lower back. On a bad day, I get radiating pain on all sides of my body. It shoots down both legs, and it feels like someone's stabbing me all the time. And so my work, after seeing this MRI, sent me to a doctor to see if there was anything they could do and see if I was a candidate for surgery. And I don't know about anyone else in here, and this is an outside issue, but I was addicted to things besides alcohol. And so it is not within my option range to take pain medication, and I'm terrified of surgery. And I'm also really dramatic, in case you haven't noticed by now. And so I went to this doctor who I've never met before, and I wrote on the intake paperwork, like in big letters, you know, I'm a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. My sobriety date is April 25th of 03. Don't you dare prescribe me anything. I will not take it. I will throw it in the trash. Rah, right? You know, get my point across. And this medical assistant calls me to the back room, and she's taking my vitals, and she's asking me, you know, the history and physical questions, and asking me about my pain level. And she says to me, she says, "Can I ask you a question?" And I was like, you know, I mean, sure. Like, you know, whatever you want to ask me, sure, go right ahead. She said, "This might be a really inappropriate question." And I said, "Well, no, that's fine. What do you want to know?" And she said, "You sponsor my friend Renee." And I said, "Oh, well, yeah, I do sponsor Renee." I said, "Wow, are you a friend of Bill W's?" And she said, "I'm 4 months sober. Will you please sponsor me?" And I said, yes, absolutely. It would be my honor to sponsor you. And she said, "Can I take your phone number off your chart?" And I said, "Sure, go right ahead. You know, take my phone number, give me a call. I'd love to hear from you." And so I saw the doctor that day. I am not a candidate for surgery. And there was nothing that they can do. There's really nothing they can do for me. They closed my case. But my important point of telling you this story is to tell you I got a service commitment. And that just made all the difference in the world. Alcoholics Anonymous, you show up when I need you. My job is to remain well-respected and well-connected here. So I'm going to talk. I'm going to tell my story because that's the thing that I feel led to do tonight. And we will take a break promptly, and I will end on time, and I'm looking forward to the questions people have to ask. So I was born July 16th, 1977. That makes me 43 years old. Don't do the math. I'll just let you know. I'm not ashamed. I'm 43 years old. That doesn't sound very old. However, I cannot believe I've lived this long. I was born to a Hispanic mother and a Persian father. Truthfully, I don't know a lot about my history. I'm actually still finding things out today about who I am. I don't know a lot about my story, my identity that's still being revealed. And what I do know is this. My mother, for reasons that I don't know, my dad did not want my mother raising me as a child. He was afraid for me. And he was not an American citizen when I was born. He actually did not become a citizen until 10 years ago. So when I was born, he was afraid of taking me from my mother. He thought that one day, if he ever got deported, I would end up in the foster care system. He didn't want to see that happen. And that's all I know about my history. What I know happened from there is that they gave me up for adoption. I spent a very short time in the foster care system, like a matter of weeks, really. And I was adopted by the people who I call my parents today. The people I call my parents are good people, great salt of the earth people, kind people. My parents come from the Midwest, both grew up in small towns in the Midwest, and they're kind of like what I envision about people from the Midwest. You know, they're just like honest, hardworking people, kind, believed in an honest day's work for an honest day's pay, cared about their neighbors, cared about their community. You know, anything that I could have had in terms of a design for living, my parents attempted to give to me. Turns out I have to burn my life to the ground to actually embrace those principles. But they attempted to give me all the good tools for living. I was brought up in a good home. My parents were both military, both service members, officers. They got out of school and through the GI Bill were able to accumulate an education. And I went to good schools. I went to private schools. My mom grew up in alcoholism. I know, thanks to Alcoholics Anonymous, that when you grow up in alcoholism, sometimes it doesn't leave room for love. My mother grew up in a very lonely home. She was abused often. She was in poverty. When she had children of her own, she made a conscious decision that she was going to tell us that she loved us, and she was going to show us the love that she had never received. How that woman transmitted what she didn't have, I'll still never know to this day. But that's what she did, y'all. Like, she was always doing things for us. I was the center of their world. You know, my sister and my brother and I, we were just, they did everything for us. And yet, what I did know at a young age was that my parents, my biological parents who had given me up for adoption, that they had kept my older sister and they had told my biological family that I died at birth. And I don't know about anybody else in here, but when I don't understand things, I like to make up little stories, you know, just kind of tell myself stories and I just decide that's the truth. And the story that I told myself at a young age is that I had been thrown away by the people who should have loved me the most in life. And I never knew what I had done wrong. And I hated the way I looked. I hated everything about myself. This is going to sound kind of silly in Virginia Beach, but I did not want to be Hispanic and Persian. I wanted to be something exotic. And, you know, people freak out about that all the time. They're like, what exactly did you want to be? I don't know. I just didn't want to be me. You know, I didn't want to look like me. I didn't want to be me. I didn't want dark hair and dark skin. I wanted to be tall. And I just wanted to be something else. And I know now whatever I was, I wouldn't have been satisfied with. But at a very early age, I started learning how to be deceitful to people. It's just the thing that I would do. I somehow decided in my mind that if you knew who I was, you weren't going to like me because I know who I am and I'm not very fond of me. So I'm sure you would not be either. So my first tool for living was lying. I lied so much it was darn near a language. And my little friends in school would find out that I was a liar. You know, one time I told my friends at school that my parents were bikers. Okay, so my mom was an attorney until she became an appellate judge. My dad was a primary care physician until he retired 4 years ago. They're not bikers. But I made this story up and my friends would come over to the house and they would look around. They'd say, gosh, you live in a nice house. You live in a nice neighborhood. Your parents aren't bikers, are they? And I'd be like, no, wait. I was just talking about someone else's parents. Like, I would make things up. And, you know, my friends would decide that they didn't want to be friends with a liar. And when you're 8 years old and you're running the world, you become thirsty. And I didn't set up this relationship with alcohol until I was 12. It was a long road to get there, but thank God we arrived. The other thing that happened when I was a kid is at 10 years old, my parents took me to a psychologist and they diagnosed me with having a very, very high IQ. I was actually considered in the top 2% of the country. I don't think that's true anymore. We know how that goes. But one of the things that I've always had is a photographic memory. I can actually memorize things. I can snap pictures. I can quote this big book in and out just because of that memory of mine. But I've always accelerated at the extraordinary, but I have a lot of trouble with the ordinary. It's not a great way to live, let me tell you, because I never had to study for a test in school, but I could never figure out my locker combination. And so I would carry all 8 books to class. I would kind of just hug my textbooks. And the kids used to get a kick out of it. They used to stick their foot out and they would trip me and I'd go flying and my books would go flying. And in my opinion, if you ever see a kid that lives like that, you should just give them a drink. It's just not fair, you know? As I said, I did not set up this relationship with alcohol until I was 12 years old. I love stories in Alcoholics Anonymous, how people go to parties and they drink alcohol and they are like dancing on the tables and they're having sex with every good looking person in the room. I have to tell you, that's not my story. I started my drinking and I ended my drinking alone, just so we're clear. That's the kind of loser I am. I got into my parents' liquor cabinet at 12 years old and got a bunch of their booze and started drinking because I wanted to change the way I felt. And at 12 years old, when I finally experienced the magic of alcohol after some experimentation, when the room started spinning and my head got really, really warm and my hair got really tingly and I just could not feel my arms and I couldn't feel my legs and I couldn't tell if I was sitting or standing and I felt giggly and I felt giddy and just felt so happy. I just really, really enjoyed myself and it just made everything all right where I was. When I drink alcohol, I know today that it flips a switch in my head that says, I don't care what you think about me. I don't care what's happening around me. When I drink alcohol, I find the spiritual principle of whatever. And that's what I love. I also know that when I drink alcohol, I begin to know a new freedom and a new happiness. I do not regret the past nor wish to shut the door on it. I can comprehend the word serenity and girl, I look good. And that's the way I've always wanted to feel. And I don't feel that way when I'm not drinking. When I am not drinking, I don't like being Hispanic and Persian. I don't like the way I look. I don't like the way I sound. I'm comparing my insides to your outsides and I'm coming up short all the time. But when I drink alcohol, it doesn't really matter what's happening around me. It doesn't really matter what you think and feel. And yeah, you become somewhat interesting, but darn sure not as interesting as I am. So for me, alcohol is quite magical. And I set up this relationship with alcohol from the get-go. I decided that I would pursue it to the gates of insanity and almost death. Now, another interesting thing that happened at 12 years old is that I got committed to my first mental institution. I don't know about anyone else in here, but I would have these periodic nervous breakdowns. You know, my nerves would break down from time to time, and it was just never a great thing. And my parents sought the help of a psychiatrist, and they made a conscious decision to institutionalize me. And back then, they could institutionalize you for a while. I went in at 12 years old. I got out a month before I turned 14. So I got out on June 21st, which is the day of the equinox, the longest day in the year. No surprise there. I got out in June. I turned 14 in July. And in August, I started high school. So this high school got my transcripts from this mental institution. And they didn't know what to do with a little budding alcoholic of my type. But it was an interesting time in history. It was No Child Left Behind. What that means is that they're going to graduate you. They just have to figure out how to do it. So they stuck me in the Challenger program. That was for gang members and pregnant teenagers. And I was neither one, but they kind of stuck me in there to figure out what to do with me. And they made this interesting provision for me. They gave me this wooden hall pass. I remember it very distinctly. It said pass. They said, now, anytime you feel like you're going to freak out, show the hall pass to the teacher. They'll let you go. No questions asked. Now, that's a great thing when you're practicing alcoholism in high school, because I'd be sitting in class and my drink alarm would go off and I would just show the pass and I would take off. And I wasn't supposed to be going where I normally go, which is behind the dumpster, smoking outside issues and drinking Boone's Farm Strawberry Hill and Thunderbird and Night Train. Big shout out to Thunderbird. Anyway, what I was supposed to be doing is I was supposed to be going to this counselor's office. And I used to talk about her a lot when I would speak in AA meetings. She was an unlikely angel in my life. Her name was Lorraine Grant. I used to say, if anybody knows her, please see me after the meeting because I owe this woman an amends. About 3 years ago, I was speaking in Florida, of all places. And this really young girl came up to me after the meeting and she goes, oh my God, I hope you don't think this is weird, but I looked up your counselor. Is this her? She found her on social media. And so I was able to reach out and make this amends. So we're friends on Facebook today, Lorraine and I. She tried desperately to get through to me. And at this point in my story, I'm hiding behind a wall of sarcasm and condescending remarks. I'm so deep inside myself, you can't even reach me. And she used to try to get through to me and help me. She would ask me questions, like about my relationship with my mom. And I used to say these inappropriate things to her. I used to say things like, well, I'm thinking about killing her and burying her in the backyard. What do you think? Back then, I dressed in all black. I wore combat boots. I had a mohawk. I was not a vision for you. So anyway, they got tired of this little charade. And I got approached by the administration of the high school. And they said, look, we're going to put you in a new program. It's called the Full Day Cooperative Education Program. That means you don't have to come to school. Don't come to school. Just go get a job, show us your paycheck stubs, and we're going to graduate you from high school. And that's what happened. I got me a little job. I showed them my paycheck stubs, and they graduated me from high school at 17 years old with what I now know is the equivalence of a sixth grade education, because that's the last time I learned anything in a classroom. So at 17 years old, one of the values of my family is that they believed in higher learning. They wanted us to try to pursue an education. So they asked me to go to college. And so I did apply for a college and I got accepted and I got kicked out of that college because I drank too much. That was Kansas City Art Institute in Kansas City, Missouri. After leaving that college, because I violated a lot of their rules and I was drinking and everything was getting out of control, I came home at 17 years old and I altered my documents to say that I was older. And at age 17, I got into the topless bar industry. I got in when I was 17. I got out when I was 25. I got sober at 25. So that gives you a little picture of who walked in the rooms when I came in. Thank God, Alcoholics Anonymous, you don't expect people to clean up their mouth and dress appropriately to sit in your rooms. Also, at the time that I came into AA at age 25, I had been arrested several times. I learned in Alcoholics Anonymous, if you've been arrested more than three times, all you have to say is several. I've been arrested several times. I've also been institutionalized several times. And as far as that business is concerned, the topless bar industry, I do not talk negatively about that business. What I will tell you is that there are women that work in that business that do the right things. They feed their kids, they go to school, they come home at night. What I will tell you is I'm not that kind of woman. I'm an alcoholic. I wreck shop. You give me a little bit of money or what I perceive to be a little bit of power and I become a tornado roaring through the lives of others. That's how I show up. Now, I'm also a bit of a hostage taker by trade because I do believe that hostage taking is an important life skill. I don't know if there's any other hostage takers in the room, but if you are in training for hostage taking 101, I'm just going to give you some tips. You have to find people that have things in common with you. You know, I like chocolate ice cream. They like chocolate ice cream. As far as I'm concerned, we go together. And I'm the type that once you start dating me, oh, no, no, you're not going to break up with me. Oh, no. I will scale your gated community wall, and I am coming to your job because that's how much I love you. So I met this old boy when I was working in the club. After talking for a little bit and finding out that we had quite a bit in common, what I found out is that he talked like I did, he drank like I did, and he lied like I did. And ladies, what do you do with a diamond like that? You get your hands on him. You don't want your girlfriends to get him. So I got my claws in this old boy right away. We moved in and we set up housekeeping immediately. Now, you can let your imagination go as far as what you want to, what two actively drinking alcoholics living together looks like. A friend of mine described us best. Our love was so big, we had to take it outside. You know, we had that real good love. It was just real. You know, and we had to put it on display for the neighborhood because we are pillars of the community. We want to be an example of what a good relationship looks like. So we would go out into the cul-de-sac and we would fight and scream and put hands on each other on a regular basis. And, you know, the reason why we stayed together as long as we did is because both of us said we were going to leave the other one once we sobered up, which did not happen for a very long time. And I have to tell you that I am the only one sober between the two of us. Paul died when I was 3 years sober, and I am not very clear about why me and not him. Those are not answers that I have. What I do know is that I've been given a huge gift called sobriety that works in spite of me. And I need to spend every day showing my gratitude for what I have. The reason that that relationship ended, it's important that I am honest in the rooms of AA. All jokes aside, is that when in 1999, I was 21 years old and the Spurs won their first championship. I remember it distinctly. We've won five now, just so we're clear. We've won five, go Spurs. At that time, we were winning our first championship against the Knicks. Sorry, New Yorkers. And I was celebrating our win, and I could not keep any alcohol down. I remember that distinctly. I just could not. I was drinking, and I couldn't keep anything down. And I was sick for a couple of weeks. And I'm very irresponsible, too, because I don't go to the doctor. And it wasn't for a while that I finally got checked out. And what I discovered is that I was towards the end of my first trimester. I was pregnant. And I know that most women, when they find out that they are pregnant, they feel the movement of the baby in their stomach and they are excited. I have to tell you that that was not my story. I knew that I could not stay sober for 9 months. I never wanted any child to have a mother like me. Towards that part of my story, I was bulimic and I was cutting myself in places that people could not see. I hated myself distinctly. And I didn't want to stay with him. And I felt that I was going to be trapped with him forever. And I saw, because as far as I was concerned, he was the problem. You know, he did cocaine, so he was definitely the problem out of the two of us. And so I also thought that this child would take away the only thing that made me worthwhile in this world, and that is my body, because I had nothing else going for me. This is the only shot I got to make anything work. And so I terminated that pregnancy. And when that happened, he decided to leave me. And that's just a part of my story that I cannot ever take back. It is the only story I have. But when he left me, I thought to myself, oh, thank God. You know, thank God he's gone. I'm going to get my life together. You know, the problem is out of my life. I am going to get my life together and I'm going to put it all together. And I don't know how you get your life together, but I buy an outfit, you know. Because you got to get it looking good for the next one, right? You know, you just got to get it all nice and beat and snatched and it'll look fabulous. And I'm going to get me another one and we're going to get this thing together. You can't keep me down. And so I bought me an outfit and my life went to hell. I started going in and out of jails and in and out of institutions on a regular basis. Sometimes I'm going to institutions because I'm drinking too much, but most of the time it's because I'm trying not to drink. All I know is there is something wrong with me. I didn't have words like our big book has. I didn't know it was the hideous four horsemen. All I knew is that I woke up every morning and the coast was not clear. I started being diagnosed with everything under the sun. If it's in the DSM-5, I have it, just so we're clear. They started giving me all these pills. I was taking pills 4, 5, 6, 7 times a day and life was not getting any better. I had a pill box the size of my home group's chip box back then. And we have a lot of old timers. You know, and I don't know if anybody else has been on psychotropic meds before, but the kind of meds that they put me on, I would take those meds and I would drink and I'd be sitting there watching TV and I would black out and I'd wake up and I had Doritos all over my face. You know, I'm starting to lose these big gaps of time. I'm getting to work and I don't even know how I got there. I'm barely even dressed when I get there. Like I'm starting to black out on a regular basis and I would just sit on the couch. I would eat and I would sleep and I'd go to work. I gained a bunch of weight. I was 65 pounds heavier than I am right now. I wore the same clothes. I never changed my clothes. I didn't shower. I wore the same pink jumpsuit for like a month. I thought I looked like J-Lo. I didn't. It got to the point where I became unemployable for the kind of work I do, which I'm not judging anybody for anyone's lifestyle inside or outside the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. But when taking your clothes off for money is no longer an option, you might want to get a white chip. I'm just saying. That's how I hit. I hit the lowest of the low here. You know, nobody will even pay me to do the kind of dirty work that I used to do. And that's inside the club and outside the club. I am an unwelcome hanger-on. That's where my life takes me. I did what a girl like me does. I took another hostage. Now, I'm not proud of this. And I have to tell you that it took this young man 3 years before he would listen to my amends. I set the deal up. I knew he liked me. I don't know what was going on in his life that he thought a girl who wore the same pink jumpsuit for a month was a little bit of all right. But I set the deal up. I said, look, you like me. I think I could like you. I'm going to move in with you. You're going to take care of me and I'm going to behave myself. Two out of three happened. The truth of the matter is when I moved in with this guy, I was very abusive. I drank around the clock. I was a horrible, horrible girlfriend, just horrible. I was drunk all the time. I was unfaithful. I was hustling on the side, doing things that you shouldn't do in a relationship. And anytime he would talk to me about not cheating on him, I would say things to him like, if you're going to talk to me like that, I'm going to leave. I was horribly abusive. It's nothing that I am proud of, but again, it's the only story I have. If you are in this room and you are new and you hear us laughing about these stories and you're probably thinking to yourself, this is not funny, I get you. When I walked into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, none of this was funny. It's not funny when it's happening to you. But the thing that they promised me when I came to AA is you cannot laugh about something that hasn't healed. They said, keep coming back. If it can heal for one of us, it can heal for all of us. Ellen C. taught me that. You have to keep coming back. None of this was funny. It was humiliating. I prayed that these stories would never see the light of day. But I can talk about any of these stories here in Alcoholics Anonymous because they don't own me today, thanks to the ninth step. After living with that old boy for a while, I ended up overdosing on his couch. He found me one day. I wasn't breathing, and he called EMS. I was rushed to University Hospital one more time. This was not my worst drinking story. I didn't come to Alcoholics Anonymous because of the consequences of my drinking. I'm one of those who will never be able to bring into the subconsciousness with sufficient force the suffering of a week or even a month ago. I am also not scared of consequences. They mean nothing to me. It's always scary the first time you get arrested. It's always easier the second time. It's always traumatizing the first time they put you in a mental institution. By the second, third, and so on, I've got my shoelaces and my belt off during the intake, and I'm already looking for a date because that's how I do. You know, I didn't come to AA because I was afraid of the consequences. The reason I came to AA is because in the last 3 years of my drinking, I was restless, irritable, discontent, and drunk. And I've been taught by many old timers since the day that I walked in the rooms that if your drinking has stopped working, it will never work again. That you are either going to have to find a program called Alcoholics Anonymous and work the steps, or you are going to end up going on to the bitter end and you will buy a gun in the pawn shop because that's how a lot of us end up. I'm so grateful that they told me the truth about my disease when I came in here. I'm so grateful those old timers opened the big book and they showed me page 52 where it talks about the bedevilments, that I am prey to misery and depression, that I have a feeling of uselessness, that I am full of fear and I am unhappy. That describes my life when I'm drinking and when I'm not. In the beginning of my drinking, I had some relief from those bedevilments, but towards the end of my drinking, I couldn't find any relief. And thank God I was lifted out of the ashes and brought to Alcoholics Anonymous. And how that happened is my parents walked in and they told me to get some help or they were going to walk away from me. I was driven to a treatment center in the Hill Country on April 25th of 03. That is my sobriety date. Now the treatment center did their job. They separated me from alcohol for the last time. And if you're anything like me, life does not get any better when you stop drinking. I started feeling like I was going to come apart at the seams. I would have these horrible, horrible, shameful memories. And when I would have them, these flashbacks, they would just bring me to my knees. I was in so much pain sometimes. I felt like I couldn't take a breath. But the treatment center did their job. They started talking to me about alcoholism, not the way you talk to me, but they opened a door for me. And the door that they opened is a door in my mind that for an alcoholic of my type, the only solution would be Alcoholics Anonymous. They said, when you get out of treatment, don't unpack, don't go on a trip, don't go get you another boyfriend. That's okay. I had like four of them. The treatment center was full of them and I needed commissary. They said, go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and start working the steps because clearly your life depends on it. They also suggested that I go to a halfway house. Shout out to my halfway house folks in here, if you're in here. I know that's not a part of AA, but when you have nowhere to go, that's where you live. I lived in a two-story house with 18 women and two bathrooms. And that's not a big deal. I mean, I've certainly been in worse places. But when I lived in this halfway house, they used to have a chore list on the wall. And you had to do two chores. And I don't know about anybody else in here, but I did not know how to do chores when I got sober. Yes, I had lived on my own before, but I just didn't like when I did dishes, I just kind of wiped the bowl clean. That's just how I am. So they taught me how to do chores. They taught me how to clean. They taught me how to be responsible. They taught me how to follow a curfew. I remember they put the mop in my hand and they told me to like put some soap and some water on it. And they were like, okay, now move the mop to the left and move it back to the right. And I was up there mopping in stiletto heels. I was like, I can't do this. But I do know how to mop today. I showed up to my first home group, which was the world famous group of 2211 of Alcoholics Anonymous, and they just loved me. There was a guy in my home group. His name is Frank F. He's a little famous in the Houston area. He and another member of AA got into a fist fight outside an AA meeting over who had the most serenity, right? And, you know, I know sometimes we see our members' behavior and we think, what a bad example of Alcoholics Anonymous. He's not applying these principles in his life. I have to tell you, I identified with Frank. I totally got Frank, you know? I was like, I get you, Frank. So my home group was great, you know? I met the woman who was to become my idol in sobriety. Her name is Gail S. from Kerrville, Texas, who got sober in the Tyler group of Alcoholics Anonymous. Gail and Joe were a force in my life, and I say past tense because both of them have died within the past year. My heart is so much heavier without them. You know, I hope that wherever you go to meetings, there are people in the rooms that make the world a safer place to be. That was my Gail and Joe. I would walk into the room and those worldly clamors, mostly those within myself, would be on me. And I was just, you know, ready to just go off. And I would walk into the room and I would see Gail and Joe and I knew I was going to be okay. And Gail was one of those beautiful women. She was 39 years sober and she would just kind of radiate God. And I remember she would just sashay over to me. And in that sweet little voice of hers, she would say to me, baby, let me tell you something. And I would say, yes, Miss Gail, what is it? And she'd say, for God's sake, honey, get your toes done. And then she'd walk off. Now, I have to let you know that I have my toes done today. And that's a tribute to Gail S., who I always wondered what she had. And if you asked me what she had back then, I would tell you I didn't know. I know what it is today. Gail is as beautiful on the inside as she is on the outside. I always thought if I cleaned up the outside, somehow the inside would clean up. But that's not how this program works. This is an inside job. My friend Candace M. says it best. If you do not go within, you go without in this program. It's an inside job. Now, I met the woman who was to become my sponsor in sobriety. Her name is Annie M. from Kerrville, Texas, who sobered up in the suburban group of Austin, Texas. As I've told you already, I am a product of some really mean sponsorship. And I don't want you to get it twisted. Nancy B. from Denton, Texas gave me the best definition of a mean sponsor. She said it's someone who cares more about what you're doing than how you're feeling. That's the kind of sponsorship I had. Annie would say things to me like, it's not like I don't care about how you feel. It's, do you not want to feel that way anymore? For that, we have a solution. And Annie taught me how to live in Alcoholics Anonymous. Very vital for a girl like me. She taught me how to live in here because I believe if I can live in here, I can survive out there. Every good thing I've ever learned, I learned in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was taught to be on time where I come from. That's 15 minutes early. And I was taught to stay late. I was taught to work the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous and not the room. I think that's important. I was also taught to dress appropriately and watch my language. Now, I have a myriad of cuss words in my vocabulary, but you won't hear any of those tonight. Because I was taught that if I love a fellowship called Alcoholics Anonymous, my actions, my words, and my clothes should show it, that the outward appearance should match the inward reality. And it turns out if you go to work on time and you dress appropriately and you watch your language, you get to keep your job. It's just crazy to me. So I don't want to miss the most important part. Annie opened the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous and started taking me through that 12-step process. And as that 12-step process started taking place in my life, what happened to me is what it describes in the back of our book, Appendix 2, Spiritual Experience, where it says the personality change sufficient to overcome alcoholism occurred. I believe that the woman who walked in here on April 25th of 03 will always drink again. I can't be her. I don't want to be her. But see, oven by myself, I can't make that change take place. When the big book talks about lack of power being my dilemma, they're not just talking about alcohol. It was very clear to me when it says that a set of spiritual principles would solve all my problems, because drinking is but a symptom. In fact, I hang my hat on the part of the book where it says, the insanity returns and we drink again. I'm clear that it doesn't happen in reverse. Long before I ever take a drink, my behavior is going to show where I'm headed. But the purpose of the steps, the purpose of those 12 steps is to shrink my ego down small enough to experience the spirit or have a spiritual experience, however you want to say it. The closer I am to God, the further away from a drink. I'm very clear. Now, yes, I had a problem with the God thing. And if you're in here and you have a problem with the God thing, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous, honey. That's why we call it we agnostics, not those agnostics. They were very clear that a woman like me was going to walk into these rooms. Coming from the dark past that I come from, you think I was walking in here praying and meditating and doing yoga and all that stuff? No, ma'am. No, no. I was doing some other things, but it wasn't spiritual. I did have a problem with the God thing, but the great thing that my sponsor told me is she said, if you're willing to take the 12 spiritual steps, that the process would yield the results. She told me things like, you can have a big God and pray very little. She would say, faith without works is dead. She'd say, you can believe all kinds of things. You can have a great conception of God. And if there is no action behind it, if there's no application, you won't stay with us. But you can believe in absolutely nothing or be totally unsure and take the spiritual steps and you can stay sober because the process yields the results. We are an action program. We are action-oriented people. I don't have to believe that chemotherapy works. If I take it, I can be cured of cancer. And as a result of working all 12 steps in my life, I had a spiritual awakening. An awakening is just the description of the word, by every means of the word, to become aware. As a result of working all 12 steps in my life, what happened to me is I became awake and aware of the presence of a loving God that had been there the whole time. It is that I was able to see it for the first time. And I've never been the same since. Now, have I been relieved of selfishness and the burden of self? No, I have to have a daily reprieve for that. But I have always been clear about where I need to be in Alcoholics Anonymous. I've never left you. I've been in the middle of all three sides of the triangle since the day I came in, thanks to good sponsorship. And nowadays, because I need to be and I want to be. I am my best self when I am with you. There is no better description or version of me than when I'm with you all the time. And believe me, my family thanks you too, because I have certainly been clear over the years that I do not need alcohol to burn my life to the ground. I've done that sober too. But when I'm doing all three sides of the triangle, the sky's the limit. My sponsor promised me if I was willing to carry the message in Alcoholics Anonymous at any capacity that I was asked to. She said, if you say yes in Alcoholics Anonymous, many amazing things are going to happen to you in between service commitments. And I'm here to tell you that they have. Remember how I told you that I lived in that halfway house? Well, when I was about a year sober, I got to run that halfway house. I got to teach girls how to mop. It's quite an interesting experience, you know. We don't ever talk about what happens after the spiritual awakening, how the ego rebuilds itself. You know, I forgot about how crazy I was when I came in. And I would go to meetings and my home group would ask me how the girls were doing, how the girls in the house were doing. And I'd be like, oh, my God, they are just so not acting right. And, you know, I gotta love those AA women in Texas. They were like, well, darling, why don't you give them the right to be new for five minutes? We let you be new for 5 years. And I said, well, you might be right. You know, when I was 2 years sober, I went and worked in the Kerrville State Hospital. When I was 3 years sober, I went and worked in a treatment center. I used to say, all I have to do is work in Bexar County Jail and I'll have worked where I've lived. But I've now worked in Bexar County Jail, just so we're clear. Life comes full circle, you know. You keep saying yes in Alcoholics Anonymous. You keep doing service commitments. And before you know it, you open your eyes, you close your eyes, and you have lived life full circle again. For all those amends that I was never able to make, God has put people in my life that I can make those karmatic amends. For all of those things that I wish I had done right, I got to do them again. It's so great to be a part of the human chain, you know, to just be a link in the human chain that brings life together, to be a part of the solution, and especially in a community that I once destroyed. Now, I have to tell a couple of stories before I stop talking, because these stories are, well, I just love these stories, honestly. I'm not going to lie. They're just fabulous. I get so excited to tell them. I'm excited just thinking about it right now. But the other reason is because I believe that these stories, while they happen to me, they belong to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. So here's story one. I had decided a long time ago, I had this old idea. Now, my old friend Ed Mutum used to say, if you've thought it before, it's an old idea. So I had this old idea. And my old idea was that I was not college material. I had evidence. Remember I told you I got kicked out of Kansas City Art Institute? Well, just to be very clear, I've been kicked out of several universities. The last one was a junior college, which is a two-year degree. And I was there for 9 years and I didn't get a degree. That's how we do. So my stepfather, when I was about 2.5 years sober, he retired from the FBI and they gave him a small pension. And he sat me down one day and he said, I've been thinking about how I want to invest my money and I've decided I want to invest it in you. At that time, I had made my amends, and as a result of the ninth step, I was able to come home and have a wonderful relationship with all my parents. He said, I want to invest my money in you. I want you to apply for a college, and I want you to get as many scholarships as you can, and I want to help you pay for the rest. And I'm thinking to myself, I've been kicked out of several universities. I don't think I'm on the dean's prospect list, Don. And scholarships, I don't see that happening either. But I am a woman of my word. So I said, sure, Don, I'd be happy to. So I showed up to Shriner University in Kerrville, Texas, in some torn jeans and a t-shirt. I said, I'd like to apply for your school. So they gave me an application. They said, take it home, type it up, have someone edit it, make it look real neat, and return it back to us. And I said, that's not going to be necessary. Do you have a pen? So I filled out my college application in pen and I gave them $25 to process it. I said, do you need anything else? They said, we need college transcripts from all the schools you've gone to. I said, all of them? They said, yes, all of them. I said, okay, what if like hypothetically I went there for like 3 years and I didn't get a single credit? Do I have to? They said, yeah, you have to turn those in too. I was like, oh, great. Okay. So I sent all my transcripts to the university, and one day I was working at the state hospital and I get a call from the admissions office. They said they needed me to come down and sign some paperwork. And I said, why? Because I'm thinking they want me to sign something that I'm not going to sue them for not accepting me to the school or something. You know, I didn't want to waste my gas. I said, so what is this about? What do you need me to sign? Why am I having to go down there? And they said, well, here's the thing. We got your transcripts, all of them. We've never seen anything like this in our lives. You have 10 A's, 2 B's, 9 D's, 10 F's, and 11 W's, because that's how I roll. They said, your D's and your F's and your W's don't transfer. You have a 3.83 GPA, and you are eligible for the presidential scholarship. You can't make this up, y'all. I was like, so what I hear you saying is you're thinking about accepting me to your school? And they said, yes, we don't give the presidential scholarship to students that aren't coming in the fall. And so I got so excited. Oh my God, I got so excited. I was like, I got accepted to college. And I drove down to the admissions office and I couldn't get out of the car. I don't know how to let life be good. I don't know how to accept the abundance that God has for me. And I'll be honest, I'm that girl. If I'm not going to win, I don't want to play. Like, what if I fail? You know, what if I get kicked out of school? I can't take that kind of humiliation. So I'm talking to God in my car and I said, look, I know I'm not supposed to tell you you're wrong, but you are wrong. I'm the one who's destroyed all those lives. I've done terrible things. I appreciate it, but I can't accept it. And I heard a voice in my head but it was not between my ears, and it said, I am not doing this for you. And I don't know how God talks to you, but it can't be about me. You know, I get real uncomfortable real easy. I do this. I always want to like not show up to my birthday party because I don't like, believe it or not, I don't like a lot of attention. but if it's about you, I can get down with that. I can appreciate that. So I walked into the admissions office and I signed my paperwork to enroll at Shriner University in 2005. What a journey it's been. In 2007, I walked the stage with my bachelor's degree from Shriner University. And in 2010, I walked the stage with my master's degree. On April the 27th, 2015, 2 days after I turned 12 years sober, I successfully defended my dissertation and I became Dr. Stacy Speedlin. My PhD. Now you can say whatever, and I love the stories in Alcoholics Anonymous because you can't make these things up. I went from the pole to the PhD, y'all. Like, you don't get to where I am today from where I'm from on human power alone. That doesn't happen. I know what happens to girls like me. I live in my community today. I know what happens. A lot of us never made it out. But right now in this moment, I am sitting here at the university. This is my office. After I graduated with that degree, in May of 2015, I got a call from the university. They called me and they said, we have a class. We're wondering if you might teach it. And I said, well, what is the class? They said, crisis. I said, well, yes, I do have experience with that. So I started teaching the crisis class. And after a while, they hired me on as a visiting professor, which is a temporary job. And then eventually they offered me a contract. I am now an assistant professor in practice at the University of Texas at San Antonio. And I'm here at my office right now, and you guys can't see this, but across the street from my office, I have this huge window, and across the street from my office is a bridge. It's called the Commerce Street Bridge. Right across that bridge is the Bexar County Jail. Every day I get a view of where I used to live, from bridge to shore. You can't get to where I am from where I was on human power. It's a great life. I mentor a lot of students. Some of them I've brought into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. Some of them are the children of alcoholics. It is such an honor and a privilege to do what I do. I have students who are first generation. They don't know how to do college, and I get to show them what I did. I teach them what you taught me. Show up on time, dress appropriately, watch your language, read the book, get a mentor. I teach them all that. It's not rocket science. It's everything you've taught me. When I got accepted to my doctorate program, I remember I was there with like some real students, you know, like real students. They'd been real students all their lives. And they asked me, they were like, hi, where did you matriculate from? And I told them, Alcoholics Anonymous. What about you? I mean, they were like from these real big schools I've never even heard of. Anyway, one more story I have to tell you, and then I swear I'm going to be quiet. I'm so excited. This is my favorite story. I have hundreds of stories, but this is my favorite. Oh my God. Okay. Are y'all ready? Okay. So I get asked to talk in Alcoholics Anonymous. I've been speaking in AA since I was 4 years sober. I've spoken in different countries. I've spoken all over the United States. And I don't know why that is. I really don't, but it's none of my business. So 1 year, about maybe 3 years ago, I got a call from someone who asked me to speak in Lake Geneva, Wisconsin in the middle of November. And I was like, oh my God, that's cold. But I've been trained, right? Smart feet, right? Smart feet. So I said, why, yes, I'd be honored to. And so the way it works is you fly into an airport and they have a host pick you up and they drive you to the hotel and drop you off and you're just around all weekend and then you give your talk and you fly home. So my host picked me up in Chicago and drove me to Lake Geneva, Wisconsin and dropped me off at the hotel. Now, when I showed up at this hotel, I was completely blown away. It was the most beautiful hotel I have ever seen in my life. It was just gaudy. I remember it was so like, the ceilings were extremely high. Everything had this beautiful gold trim. It was just very intricate, just very, very elegant hotel. Never seen anything like this. And I've been in a lot of hotels. Anyway, This hotel, right? So big. Like there was this Christmas tree in the foyer, and the Christmas tree was so big, like the ornaments were the size of my head, right? And there were thousands of gingerbread houses, like thousands of them everywhere, just gorgeous. Oh my God. So I went up to the concierge and I said, excuse me, I've never seen a hotel like this before. What is this? Is this a Marriott? Is this an Omni? Like, what is this? And he said, oh, no, ma'am. This is not a chain hotel. This is a privately owned hotel. It stands by itself and it's the only one. And I said, wow, you know, this is nice. And he said to me, he said, ma'am, do you not know where you are? I said, no, I don't. Where am I? He goes, ma'am, this is the old Playboy Mansion. Okay, so I've always thought that I should be invited to the Playboy Mansion, you know? I didn't know I had to get sober to do it. If I had known, y'all would have gotten me so much like a long time ago. I swear to God. So anyway, I've been to the Playboy Mansion, y'all. And, you know, when we talk about, oh, if I had made a list, I would have shortchanged myself. Let me tell you, all my tacky wild dreams have come true in Alcoholics Anonymous, thanks to being of service. So if you want to have an amazing life here in Alcoholics Anonymous, I recommend you live a service-filled life. My sponsor and those above me are an example of tireless service. Now, if you are new in here, I want to promise you and I want to tell you that this program goes far beyond not drinking. That's only the first miracle. There are many more to follow, but you have to be willing to go to any length, because you can work this program just enough to pick up a chip once a year, or you can be rocketed into the fourth dimension of existence. How free do you want to be? I'm an example that you can be really free, and I will tell you the most wonderful years of my life have yet to come. I've barely tapped the surface. I want to thank you all for just allowing me to speak, and David again, and Leanne, thank you all for being of service. And that's all I have. Thank you, Alcoholics Anonymous, for my life.
Thank you so much, Stacy. Oh, that was wonderful. And we're going to hear some more from her in a minute, so stick around. I'm just going to do a little bit of business, just a couple of minutes, and then we'll get back with questions. If you have any questions for Stacy, please send them to the questions in the chat, and we'll get started with that in just a second. Okay, so our self-supporting green card, the seventh tradition states that every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. While contributions cover each group's rent and other expenses, the seventh tradition is essential at every level of AA service. It is both a privilege and a responsibility for groups and members to ensure that not only their group, but also their intergroup, central office, local services, district area, and the general service office remain self-supporting. This keeps AA free of outside influences that might divert us from our primary purpose, to help the alcoholic who still suffers. Our common welfare, a word about safety. Our group endeavors to provide a safe meeting place for all attendees and encourages each person here to contribute to fostering a secure and welcoming environment in which our meetings can take place. And I'm going to ask now if there are any AA announcements, any AA related announcements. You can raise your hand or let's see.
I'm an alcoholic. My name's Henry.
Hey, Henry.
Hi there. Thanks for speaking. That was wonderful. This is related to that. The Oceanfront Conference, which is held in February every year, will not be held this year for the first time in like 45 years. So as a direct result of this COVID. So if you all had attended in the past, you have received or will be receiving a letter, and we will I'm sure, be back together in February of 22. So thank you.
Thanks, Henry. Anyone else? Okay, Simple Actions is a home group. If you are interested in joining our home group or in need of a sponsor, please hang out after the meeting. Home group members, will you raise your hand? And sponsorship in AA is yours for the asking. We urge you, do not delay. If you have questions or would like additional information about sponsorship, we will be available here after we close the meeting. Please stick around. You may have come in alone, but you don't have to leave that way. Or if you'd like, you can send an email to info@simpleactions.net. And this time, I am going to turn the floor over to David, and he's going to continue with the Ask a Basket.
Thank you, Leanne. Thank you so much, Stacy. That was absolutely amazing. Just riveting. I'm still excited. So, of course, we got, also, please keep your questions coming. I've got several, but please don't be shy about sending them in, okay? Send questions to user questions. So, of course, we're going to start with relationships. So, I'm going to mash two questions together. There's one question: do you still take hostages in sobriety? And how are your relationships different? And someone says, would you be willing to share how you have shaped a sane and sound ideal? And you're still muted.
Okay, so I'll answer the last question first. How did I shape a sane and sound ideal? The Big Book is very specific on how we do that. When you answer those questions that are outlined on page 70, it says, in this way, we tried to shape a sane and sound ideal for our future sex life. And it comes with us inventorying every relationship of the past. And the spiritual question is the very last one, where it says, what could we have done instead? That's how I shape the sane and sound ideal for my future sex life. And I tell you that to tell you this. I would love to tell you that one inventory took care of it all, and that I did not screw up any relationships in sobriety. I always laugh when people talk about waiting a year to be in a relationship, because I screwed up many of them past 1 year. So apparently time doesn't necessarily change behavior. I am one of those who had to learn a lot about what I didn't want before I knew what I wanted. It sounds tacky, but if they had all their teeth and a good job, I was willing to date them in early sobriety. And then I had to realize, okay, sober might help too. And then maybe someone who is considerate. So I gradually had to build an ideal for what I wanted and continue to examine who I was and how I show up in relationships. Because when I change, the people that I attract changes. And am I still taking hostages? Yes, I took my final hostage on September the 17th of 2017, I took my last hostage, and, you know, I am married today. And please don't laugh about this. I hope y'all don't look differently at me, but I married a Bexar County judge, and we are happily married. I know. It's just, you know, it wouldn't work out unless I had the principles of the program. I'll tell you that, because my judge was an attorney for 17 years and is quite skeptical and leery of people. So it's a good thing I'm a trustworthy person today, or this would not have worked out.
Beautiful. I have a question here. How can a newcomer handle those horrible feelings and memories and remorse in early sobriety?
Yes. Gosh, those are really, really tough. Regardless of whether you have a God of your own understanding in your life, I recommend that you pray. My sponsor, one of the first things that she taught me was the third step prayer, because she told me when you say this prayer, it will remind you that those terrible experiences of the past have a purpose and you just haven't seen it yet. And so when I would get those horrible memories, I kept the third step on an index card and I would say the third step prayer almost to just convince those memories to go away. And it worked for me. It's not easy though. I get that.
There's a segue there. What did the decision of this third step look like for you early on? And what does it look like today?
Great question, because those are two very different things. When I first came in, my third step, what it looked like is I just said, help me. And I didn't even know I was taking the third step. With the help of a sponsor, we looked at those pages, 61, 62, and 63, 60, 61, and 62 primarily. And we examined what my life looks like, whether I'm drunk or sober, when I'm running the show, and how it's hardly a success. So regardless of whether I had a belief in a higher power or whether I even wanted to continue on with the steps, because some of those steps seemed very drastic in the beginning, I knew that if I kept running my life, I was going to destroy it, and I was going to destroy people around me. And what it looks like for me today is to remain surrendered. When I stop surrendering, I end up with a very long list of amends. And I frankly just don't like to live like that anymore.
You you said a lot of things that struck me, but one of them that I wrote down was given to you as well. You talked a lot about action, and I just love the phrase, you can have a big God and pray very little. Mm-hmm. And so I just wonder if there's any more meat on the bone there. Is there any more to say about that?
I have been sober long enough to know people who have a lot of great words and great wisdom to share about what they believe God is like or their higher power is like. But when the application is not behind them, the needed power is not there. I mean, it really is an action-oriented program. And the other thing that I will add to that, that you might find to be significant, is the fact that, I have it written in my book here. You know, when it talks about knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out, that's a knowledge and power step. I love knowledge and I love power. But what I have come to find is that if I have a vision for what my life should look like, I won't do God's will. In order to do God's will, I cannot have a way. I can't have a desired outcome. I can't have an idea. When I came into AA, if you had asked me what would make my life complete, I would have told you it would be marrying the vice president of Mercedes-Benz. I don't know him, but I just knew that if I married him and I had one Mercedes for each foot and I could roller skate down the street, I would be sober for the rest of my life. I'm so glad I didn't get that wish. I mean, I would have missed a PhD, you know, I would have missed a real great plan outlined for my life that I really never would have asked for. This was not it.
Would you care to share a little more about steps 4 and 5, doing your inventory, maybe what that looks like today or in the beginning, or what that first fifth step did for you? Or is there anything in there? We do have a lot of newcomers. One or two who haven't quite done the fifth step yet.
Sure. I used to sit in the rooms of AA for my new folks, my new friends. I used to sit in the rooms of AA and I would hear people talk about how frightening the fourth and fifth step was. It was just horrible. It was frightening. Oh my God, it's just the worst thing ever. And I now realize that everyone who said that hadn't done it yet. The ones who have done it seem to be okay. In fact, they're the ones who have a life that I want. So if you are worried about doing 4 and 5, look at the people who have done 4 and 5. And that's a great litmus test for what you want. My experience with people who don't do 4 and 5 is they continue to live the same life. They're just living it sober. And what's frightening about that is when you have to make all those same mistakes sober and you got no insulation, like no alcohol to drink, to not be in pain after you make those mistakes again, it's not a great existence. If you can stay sober, it's just not a great existence. The other thing I'll say to my new friends is if you don't want to do a fourth step, you don't have to. I'm going to give you the alternative route. What you can do is you can call every ex that you've ever dated, everyone in your family, everyone who's ever given you a job, anyone who's ever loaned you money, all financial creditors, all your neighbors, call the IRS and the local police department, call your in-laws, call anyone who's ever encountered you before and invite them all to a meeting and bring them all in to the meeting and give them all a notepad and a piece of, you know, a pen and a piece of paper and just say, I am trying to figure out what my character defects are and in what ways do I act selfish? Could you care to write those down for me? And that will get you out of a fourth step.
Brilliant. Let's see. I got this question, then I was invited to clean up the grammar. Haha. But the question sounds like this. Would you be willing to elaborate on any step 6 and 7 experiences?
Step 6 and step 7, while those two steps are intertwined and go together, there are very separate experiences with both. Before I ever can take the 7th step, I have to experience the 6th. And sometimes what that looks like for me today is I have these defects of character that, well, they seem to be kind of negative in my life, but I still get a little bit of mileage out of them. And it's not until sometimes I'm confronted with very painful experiences that I experience step 6 around them. One example is I was asked to serve on a committee that was part of an organization that I felt very privileged to be a part of. And because of my poor time management issues, I failed to show up to 2 very important meetings. And I called to apologize to the person because I had forgotten to calendar both of those meetings. And the person that I called said to me, we had to make a lot of decisions without you being there, and it didn't feel good to have to carry your weight. And when she said that, it caused me a great deal of pain, and I have not done that since. It's like step 6 kicked in immediately, and I did what I've been taught to do. I hit my knees, and I asked the God of my understanding to take that defect of character away, because I don't like the person I am when I've got that defect. So my 6 and 7 experiences are, if you are not entirely ready to have these defects removed by the time you have written your inventory and shared it with a sponsor, life has a funny way of making you ready. So just hang in there and more is revealed.
Right on. Stacy, did you ever have an amends just go horribly wrong or maybe seem to go horribly wrong and turned out to be just fine?
Sure. I've had some interesting ones, but you asked about horribly wrong and turned out to be fine. So I'll give you that one. That old guy that I got into the relationship with at the end of my sobriety, the last hostage that I took, I mentioned how it was 3 years before he would sit down with me. When I was a year sober, maybe somewhere between 9 and 11 months, I tried to make that amends to him. And I remember calling him and asking him if I could make an amends. And he said, well, where are you now? And I said, I live in Kerrville, which is where I was living at the time. And I'm sober now, and I'd love to sit down with you. And he goes, oh, you're in Kerrville? I said, yes. He said, I hope you die there. And he hung up on me. And rightly so. I mean, trust me, the way I did this guy, I don't even have time to go into the horrible things that I did. And my sponsor was a big believer that when people are angry at you, they have reason to be. It's not, you know, it's no favor to them that I'm sober and living in AA now. She said, keep putting your side of the bridge down and eventually they may put their side down. And at 3 years sober, I ran into him and was able to make the amends and we went to lunch. And it was a very nice, very heartfelt amends. And, you know, one of the things that was the worst about my behavior that I was never proud of is when he would upset me, when I didn't get my way, I used to talk to him like a dog. And that was even in early sobriety. He had actually come to the treatment center and had brought me a gift. And I was so self-centered, I couldn't be bothered with him. Like, that's how horrible I was when I got sober. And so, you know, sitting down with him and making those amends was very meaningful to me. But fast forward about 6 or 7 years sober, I got a call from him and he started calling me a lot and I didn't think anything of it. You know, he was just calling and he was in a relationship with another girl who was taking advantage of him. And I would say things to him like, you know, Will, I think you're too nice of a guy. I don't think you deserve this kind of behavior. This woman has obviously not left her ex-husband. You know, there's a lot of chaos around you and it seems like she's taking advantage of you. And he would call me a lot just to hear that he didn't have to live like that. And I ended up referring him to Al-Anon. And, you know, it took me years before I looked back in retrospect and understood the magnitude of the fact that of all people to call, he would trust me. So that was where healing comes full circle. It's like when I don't do it right the first time, I get to do it right the next time. And that felt good. I haven't heard from him in a very long time. He'll probably appear now that I said that. But to have been able to have righted that wrong felt good.
How did you make the initial approach with your parents, and what did those amends look like? And I'm also curious if your journey has put you in contact with your biological parents as well.
So how did I start the journey with my parents? I started it out wrong. Keep in mind, you know, when you get sober, the psychic change doesn't occur on the first day. So, you know, I was like really excited that AA like let me sit in their rooms and they didn't kick me out and they like gave me things to do. I thought like when y'all made me the treasurer of my home group, I was just like, you know, well, you know, and I just felt so important. And I would go home and I would brag to my mother about it. I'd tell her, you know, oh yeah, and these newcomers are calling me and I'm shaking hands at the front door, Mom. And like, I'm just like one of the best greeters in my home group. And, you know, I'm chairing a meeting. And like, I would go on and on about what I was doing in AA. And in our big book, it talks about not leading with the chin. So my mom listened for a long time and she said, well, Stacy, I'm really glad you're doing well in AA, but when are you going to start paying your bills? Because your dad and I have been paying your bills since you went to treatment. And it finally hit me what they meant. It's like, it's no favor to anybody that I'm sober. They're happy that I have a great life, but they also want me to make things right. So I started out not on the right footing with my family. Today, I have a wonderful, wonderful relationship with my family. It's far beyond what I could have imagined. As far as my biological parents, I do know who they are. I have a wonderful relationship with my biological dad. I got in contact with him at 3.5 years sober, and I didn't know how I was going to do it. My adoptive mother encouraged me to reach out to him. She was like, you know, I think you should contact your father. And I said, I'm doing really good. I don't really need to know him. I mean, honestly, like I've got you, I've got dad, I'm good. And she said, well, maybe he needs to hear from you. And when she said that, I knew what she meant. You know, maybe I could be a part of this man's healing. Maybe he hasn't healed as a result of his decision. So I asked her, I said, how do I get in contact with him after consulting with my sponsor? And she said, I don't know. But in 1983, he called from this phone number and maybe you can call and see if they know him. And when I called that number, he actually picked up the phone. And, you know, when we talk about old ideas, I mean, I had an old idea that I'd been thrown away by the people who should have loved me the most. And I have to tell you that that's a false story. The true story is that my dad never changed his number and he never moved. When I was 16 years old, he actually bought an old Volkswagen Beetle and he fixed it up because he thought one day I would call him and tell him I needed a car. He didn't sell that car until I was 22 years old. The love of a father like that is beyond my comprehension. You know, it was the first time I really understood an unconditional love at a level that I had never experienced before, that he waited his whole life for me, you know, just hoping that I would show up and having at the same time the respect to never intrude on my life. And so we have a great relationship today. My mother and I, my biological mother and I, do not have a relationship. I wish it were different. It's sometimes hard when I hear people in AA talk about baking cookies with their mom and that she's their best friend. I always feel guilty, like somehow I'm a bad member of AA. But the truth is, my mom is not well. And some decisions that she made that really put me in harm's way had to make that outcome to where I don't have her in my life. And I pray about that a lot. I hope one day it'll be different. We say in AA, as long as they're breathing, there's hope. I hold out hope for that. I look just like her.
Oh, thank you. I'm sorry if that was too personal.
Not at all. I just told y'all that I used to dance naked. You're good.
We, I have a question here. Would you please talk more about the AA triangle and what it means to be in the middle of it?
Yes. So the AA triangle, there are three legacies on that triangle. It's unity, service, and recovery. I was taught that that symbol tells me precisely what it takes to remain, not only get sober, but remain sober for the rest of my life. The unity side talks about our fellowship. So what they recommend on the unity side is to have a home group, to be a part of that home group, to take an active role in that home group, and to attend those meetings regularly. For me, that's 3 to 4 meetings a week. 3 is maintenance, 4 is spiritual growth. The recovery side is me working the 12 steps with a sponsor and eventually taking other people through the 12 steps. That's the recovery side. And then on the service side, that's where I'm of service in Alcoholics Anonymous. There are many service commitments that we have in AA at the group level, at the individual level, all the way up. So I was taught if I go to 3 to 4 meetings a week, if I work the 12 steps with my sponsor and with a newcomer, and if I am of service in Alcoholics Anonymous, that's unity, service, and recovery. We call that the three-legged stool. Now, this is a three-part disease, right? Mind, body, and spirit. So it has to have a threefold solution, which is unity, service, and recovery. Unity treats the body, recovery treats the mind, and service treats the spirit. I find that when my body is hurting, I need to be in a meeting. When my mind is getting too loud and chattery, I need to work the steps. And when my spirit is suffering, like it has been throughout COVID-19, I have to take more service commitments. And so it's possible to be on two sides of the triangle and not the third. And it's like a stool. It'll just tip over. So we have to maintain all three sides of the triangle. And that's our formula for life.
I liked your alternative to writing a fourth step. I have a question here, and I'm not exactly sure what it means, but I'm just going to read it. Uh-huh. What do you tell sponsees who say they can't accomplish something meaningful?
They can't accomplish something meaningful, like in life, I'm going to assume they mean like if they think they can't go back to school or they think they can't get a job or, oh gosh, I have a lot of those. a lot of people I sponsor who have old ideas and, you know, I get it because I had evidence too that I thought meant I wasn't going to be a great candidate for school. Some of them just look at me and they just think, my God, sponsor, if you can get a PhD, I can do anything. And that's the truth, you know? So sometimes it's by example that I show them that you can do anything. Sometimes what I do is I tell them what they told me when I came into AA. I came into a group that was really grounded in their faith, really grounded in their faith. They believed that Alcoholics Anonymous, while it's here to help us not drink and have a happy, useful life, they also believed that you would be tapped into a power source that would use you as a vehicle to do powerful things through you. I mean, and if we really are the vessel, if we believe that we are just a vessel, then there's no telling what can be done through you because you are not the source. I've had to let go of this idea that I am somehow qualified to do anything. Girl, I ain't qualified to do anything that I do in these days. Even right now, I'm sitting in an office educated far beyond my intelligence, trust me. But because I believe I am a vessel and my higher power is limitless, my job in all of this is just to keep that channel clean through 10, 11, and 12 so that the power greater than me can do things through me. Extraordinary things all the time.
What does love and tolerance mean to you?
Well, to quote Dr. Bob, we all know what love is and we all know what tolerance is. It means that when I came to AA, and I can only speak for myself, I had really bad behavior when I got here. I did. I'm sure you can just imagine. I was really inappropriate. A lot of women in my home group didn't want me to sit next to their spouses because they thought I was a predator, and I was. And people loved me and they tolerated me. And what that looked like is they would say to me, "We are so glad you're here." They didn't wait for my behavior to get better before they would love me. They just loved me because they knew that if I stayed here long enough, God would change me and I would become an amazing person, you know, that God could do amazing things with me. And so they loved me as if I was already there. I didn't have to earn anything here. I was just loved. And so I have a responsibility to do that in the rooms of AA too, not just in AA, but in my home. And I'll tell you, I love newcomers a lot more than I sometimes love my family. You know, if a newcomer spills coffee in our home group, we are on our knees, like, you know, helping them clean and getting them a new cup and patting them on the head. But let my nephew spill milk in my car. You know, how loving and tolerant am I? So love and tolerance is to treat people the way I was treated when I was new, and long before I was deserving of love, they gave it to me.
I am afraid we are out of time. As usual, this is a fast 90 minutes. I hope it was that way for you, Stacy. I'm going to ask you one more question and then let Leanne take us out. Just if you could do like a minute or two on what being a home group member has meant to you in your sobriety. And thank you.
Thank you. We are not meant to be homeless. You have to have a home base. You have to have a place where we can find you. You have to have a place where if you don't show up, we're looking for you. To not have a home group is to not be connected. This is where it all begins. And these are the people that are gonna watch you grow. I have a home group back in Kerrville that when I walk in the room, they still see me as that crazy street kid that walked in. And that's precisely the way I want to be. I'm not an orphan anymore. So the same is here for you.
Thank you so much, Stacy. And I'm going to let everybody else say thank you in just a second. I've asked BJ, she's going to read the last two paragraphs on page 164.
My name's BJ. I'm an alcoholic. And thank you so much, Stacy. That was extremely powerful. Glad to have you here. Taken from a vision view from the big book, page 164. Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order. But obviously, you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right. Great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then.
Thanks, BJ. And let's do what we do if we're in a meeting, round up in a big circle, and we'll say the Lord's Prayer. If you'd like to unmute, let's see. You should be able to unmute yourself if you'd like, and we'll say the Lord's Prayer. Our Father,
Heart
in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come.
Thy will be done.
Thy will be done.
Earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses. As we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom,
power, and the glory, forever and ever.
Amen.
Amen.
Keep coming back.
Woohoo! That was amazing, guys.
Oh my God. Awesome. Thank you so much.
That was awesome.
Stacy, really, thank you so much. I came late, but I'm so glad that I showed up. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Stacy. I appreciate it.
What a gift. What a gift.
Thank you, Stacy.
Thank you, Stacy.
Thank you, Stacy.
Thanks, Stacy.
Thank you, Leslie.
Yeah, Karina, thanks for coming.
Thank you, Stacy. That was fantastic.
Amazing.
Guys, y'all are a lot of fun.
We think so.
Yeah.
Stacy, you've given me hope. I have a son that's 38 years old, and I've never seen him. I've seen him once, and he's abandoned me since then. But you've given me hope. Thank you very much.
God bless you.
Yeah. Stacy, what a miracle about your grades when they transferred, and I mean just the litany of, you know, the spread, the sheer like range, and then just, and now you're you're a doctor. I mean, just that is crazy. It's like, I mean, what a gift, my God. And that these are things that are prompted by, you know, you doing the initial work and then that party responding and reaching back out and wanting you to do these things and wanting you to be at the school. And I mean, wow, that's just incredible. I'm so glad that I heard you tonight, and I'm so glad you were here. Thank you so much.
Thank for being you. Here.
I ditto and echo that.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and David and Leanne, thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. I love that you self-will the application in pen too. You're like, I'm writing.
Good sharing. I'll see you next week.
Did they used to call that Moxie?
Oh, yeah. That's a great word. Yeah.
We should bring back the word Moxie. I'm sad.
Totally.
And groovy and far out.
Howard, what were you going to tell me?
I was going to say that you talked about the problems you may have had with your mother. I never had problems with my mother, but I wasted about 10 years with my father because I wasn't going to make amends to him for what he did to me. And I managed to get a 6-month relationship. And I always try and remember that. I did get 6 months and not worry and carry on and be resentful about the 10 years I wasted. And I try to keep that center, if I can. I don't always do it, but to keep that center in my face, right in front of me, so that I won't be going back if I only done or didn't do this or didn't do that. I'll go nuts if I do that.
Yes. Yeah.
Thank you very much for your talk.
Thank you.
Thanks, Howard.
Somebody texted me during the meeting and said, oh my God, she's telling your story. I was like, yep. I was adopted too.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. From birth, and I searched when I was 2 years sober, I searched for my biological mother, and her husband at the time didn't know me and she wasn't interested. I went through social services and I haven't heard from her since. I still have the same phone number, but it's okay. You know, I have wonderful parents that, well, my mom's passed now, but my dad's next door, and you know, everybody's story's different, you know, but it was just awesome to hear that you got to have that relationship with your father. Biological father. Yeah.
Mm. Wow.
That's awesome.
Leanne, I love you.
What a blessing that we're all here. We're all sober, coming from all different walks of life, but you know, this thing works for us. I love it. Thank you, Leanne.
It just transcends everything.
That's right. That's right.
Well, good night, everyone, and God bless.
Thank you.
Good night. You too.
Good night.
You too. And thank you. Yes, I'm going to go to it. Yeah.
I think I'm going to get off here too. Did someone want to say something?
Yeah,
I just want to say thank you again. That was amazing. Thank you for taking the time with us.
Thank you.
Yeah, we'll let you go home from work now.
No.
Still at the office. On Sunday.
It's so dark outside, I can't see the Bexar County Jail. That's kind of Yeah.
That should be good.
Yeah, right? Yeah, I've seen that enough.
It was a joy, Stacy. Thank you.
Thank
you for calling, David. Yeah, I answered my phone. I was like, this is Dr. Speedlin. He's like, hi, I'm David. I'm a knee-walking drunk. I was like, hey.
That was
nice to hear that in the middle of the day. I was like, yeah.
Well, it always feels weird. Like, I like my first contact to be, you know, at least voice, you know. I don't want to start texting people, hey, would you come speak? And then it's like, I'm calling somebody that doesn't know me at all, you mm-hmm. know? And so I'm like, the deal is I'm a falling down drunk. I hear you are too. Yeah. Would you yeah. come talk? So yeah, Chris Raymer gave me your name, by the way.
Yeah, my buddy.
Yeah, yeah. Me too. I love that guy.
Congratulations and thank you very much.
Thank you. Well, I'm going to get off here. You all be good and I'll see you all again on Zoom.
I hope so.
Yeah. Thanks so much, Stacy.
Good night.
Bye, Stacy.
Thank you all.
Thank you, Stacy.
Thanks, Leanne.